Tracy and Emily are smart, lovable sisters who really love Lucifer for the plot. Yeah, the plot, which they overthink.
Hi. I'm here with my sister, Emily Guy Birkin. She does not use a hyphen.
That's true. And I'm here with my sister, Tracy Guy Decker, and she does use a hyphen.
And together, we are Lightbringers, where we illuminate the deeper meaning of the crime-solving devil TV show. And yeah, we're overthinking it.
So much overthinking.
And today, we are going to overthink episodes 509 and 510, Family Dinner, and Bloody Celestial Karaoke Jam.
Yes.
Yes. So, in these two episodes, we are introduced to Dennis Haysbert as God Almighty. You know, it's funny, in the rewatch, you said this last time about the Pete episodes, about how, like, in your memory, you kind of, like, forget the, like, creepy serial killer parts. And you only remember the fun parts, like, when Lucifer's, like, running around in the background trying to test his mojo on everyone.
Yeah.
I find the same thing about these two, where I remember, in my memory, both of these episodes are hilarious. And they are. But there's also actually quite a bit of pathos like sadness and empathy and like struggle and loneliness that I just forget until I'm sitting in front of the screen again. So
I do have to say, even though I knew it was coming, the line, "You do have a futon, right?" Again, just took me out.
Yeah, I remarked on that one as well.
Not only the line, like, as written, but how Haysbert delivers it.
Haysbert is so satisfying as God. Just has that sort of, like, it's not a grin exactly, but just sort of like the satisfied smile through most of his delivery. He's very satisfying. So, okay, let's stay with the first episode, with the family dinner. I think it's really interesting that Chloe is so completely embraced the idea that Lucifer projects his own problems onto the case of the week that she's actually comforted when she realizes that he instantly suspects the family. And she's like, oh, the family, not the girlfriend. It's just like, okay now. Like, she's, you know, been in this very anxious space since he literally disappeared from her perspective, just disappeared when he was about to say he loved her in the evidence room. And then she finds him much later, like, reveling at Lux. So I appreciated that. Like, as a longtime viewer, like, I felt like, it happens. And she notices it too. Like, let's just run with it and embrace it. I actually quite enjoyed that.
Well, and it, she's got this tough line to walk, both the actress and the character, you know, cause she has, like, fallen for this guy who she knows is a bad romantic choice. You know, she'd had that conversation with Linda, you know, right before they got, they had sex for the first time, where it's just like, oh, you know, he's a narcissist with huge daddy problems and commitment issues and, you know, overgrown teenager and, you know, all of the different things. So, you know, she has every right to be furious at him. And she makes it very clear, like, okay, I'm not going to do that. And I am not sure how I feel about that. You know, obviously in the show as a shipper, I'm like, yeah, let him take the time he needs. It's not about you. But, you know, as a woman navigating the world who has consistently been explicitly and implicitly asked to let him have his thing, you know, let him have his freak out or just forgive something, or he didn't really mean it. It's about his family. It's blah, 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 blah. And I'm not talking specifically about my current partner. I'm just talking about it in general, you know, because it's not just about romantic. I mean, it's, you know, at work, it's friends, it's teachers, it's everybody. Mm-hmm. I like that is frustrating. It's frustrating. Yeah. And at the same time, it's also, it seems that's what would happen, you know, that's because we as women have been socialized to do that.
Yeah. I had similar thoughts that I was like, I don't think she owes him an apology, mm-hmm. you know, like even from her mm-hmm. perspective, I don't think she owes him an apology. And in particular, like, I feel like there should have been more like, how did you disappear? Mm-hmm. You know, like he was there and then he wasn't, like the rest of the people in the precinct thought that there had been an earthquake mm-hmm. because the glass had shattered and stuff. But yeah, I feel like I agree with you on all counts. And I wonder mm-hmm. like if I could rewrite it, maybe I would push harder on the curiosity.
Yeah.
And I think that might not have been out of character for Chloe Decker, who like mm-hmm. wants to solve mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause we know that he can, like, you know, whatever, fly and move pretty quickly, but they were standing, you know, mm-hmm. really close. And then mm-hmm. she blinked and he was gone. And that I don't think he's done to her before.
I will say that considering where she was emotionally, I could see her being like, I can't poke that.
Yeah.
Like, and feeling okay. like I can't be curious about that because I can't know what happened, because if I do, like,
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why she apologized too, because it was mm-hmm. easy. It was a path forward that she had control over. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
I'd like to talk about the actual dinner.
Yeah.
So poor Linda.
When a minute feels like you almost made it.
I love their little interactions because, well, part of what's so great about this scene is that it is very familiar to anyone who's been at an uncomfortable family dinner. And Linda is like the person who married in, even though she and Amenadiel aren't together anymore. And like they're whispered back and forth. Like when she was like, I just thank God for napkins. He's like, you did better than I would have.
Yeah.
That was really like, it's one of the reasons why this show is so beloved and feels so universal in some ways, even though it's about things that are clearly not universal.
Yeah.
So, but I did want to talk about, there's something that Lucifer says that really struck me in a way that made me change how I think about the character Dennis Haysbert plays as God. So I think he's supposed to be like likable. I mean, like it's, for one thing, he's Dennis Haysbert, who's just
charming.
I mean, just mm-hmm. charming, mm-hmm. charming and handsome and that gorgeous voice and mm-hmm. all of that. And then also the way that they've written him is as someone who's well-meaning, but kind of screwed up. But also kind of didn't. And, you know, it's Lucifer starts talking about how Amenadiel self-actualized the loss of his powers and his wings. And it struck me then about how when you're in some sort of system of oppression, whether it's something like really structured, like a religion or cult, or just being a woman in the world, or a Black person in America or anything like that, one of the ways that the, you know, the structure exerts power is by having you internalize the sure. shame.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the four eyes of oppression.
I did not know there were four eyes of oppression.
The four eyes of oppression: internalized, interpersonal, institutional, and ideological.
Yeah.
The internalized is it's a pillar, because that way the oppressor is oppressing even when he's not around.
Yes. So you're self-policing and you're policing others. Mm-hmm. And so what got me about that, because I've always, you know, the first time through that didn't strike me. And I've always liked this sense that angels self-actualize, because it's elegant in a lot of ways in terms of storytelling, and also in you know, what in this universe this God has created and all of that. It also is clear in the, like, that God wanted his children to make their own way. And this is one way that happens. But the way that Amenadiel self-actualized feels like internalized oppression, because he was feeling shame. And that's why he did that. And so, I mean, that's where Lucifer's face comes from too. And that to me, like, puts a real sinister cast over Dennis Haysbert's character, in that it had to have, like, that internalized shame had to have come from somewhere. And so I thought that it was really well done in terms of, like, when Lucifer is confronting his father at the dinner table, and he's bringing up things that are legitimate concerns with a narcissistic parent. And we don't get any kind of real catharsis in that scene. And it's a lot. And it had, I was wondering how much Joe and Ildi and you know, the team were trying to get across in terms of actual bad parenthood, because Haysbert is so lovable. Whereas in some ways it would be easier if God remained absent in the show.
Mm-hmm. I read that, you know, earlier in the season, in the series, they had never intended to show God. They'd never intended to show hell either. And they broke both of those as the series went on, which is interesting. In some ways it would be easier. And I think that's also real. Like, there are very few people who are truly just bad people. I mean, you and I know one or two, but there aren't very many in the world who are truly just plain bad people.
Yeah.
And I think that, so that feels sort of accurate, especially since, you know, when Dan is like, he's like above, like, petty foibles and stuff. And Amenadiel's like, well, no, I don't think he is. You know, like, the reminder that God is one of us, to quote that song. What I think is really, I'm thinking a lot about metaphor lately, separate and different from Lucifer. I'm reading a book about metaphor, and I'm just, like, thinking a lot about the ways that we use metaphor. Humans use metaphor to learn new concepts. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's really, really elegant and satisfying about self-actualization is that the metaphor becomes real, right? The metaphor is actually, so, like, the vulnerability, even talking about vulnerability is a metaphor. For emotional closeness, you know? So to make the metaphor then, you know, actualize is really powerful and satisfying, because metaphors are satisfying. I think that's, I think it's really fascinating. I think I'm less, to me, the shame is less damning of Haysbert's God than it is for you, because I think that it's a complicated emotion. I agree. It comes from somewhere, but it's not entirely from outside. Right. I think there's definitely some internalization, and there's some, like, cooking inside that happens. I think
the fact that, like, that Michael's shoulder is crooked, and you know, Lucifer says to him, like, you know,
you have such a chip on your shoulder
that you manifested it. And then the fact that Lucifer is vulnerable, like, physically vulnerable, but around Chloe, because he's emotionally vulnerable around her. Like, that to me feels very elegant. Although, come to think of it, the reason Amenadiel was he lost his powers and he lost his wings. I was focusing on the fact that he and Maze had a relationship, and it might be that, but he had been responsible for the deaths of some humans, in which case I'm kind of okay with him feeling shame and manifesting that.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Okay. I had forgotten that, but that's.
So the other thing that's really interesting about the fact that Amenadiel's suffering is what Lucifer brings to his father is that it's Amenadiel's suffering. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does talk about his own, but because Michael brings it up first, mm-hmm. You had a kingdom to rule over, right? That's why he brings up how horrible it was to be in hell and to be forced to torture souls. Mm-hmm. He doesn't bring it up on his own. He doesn't say, like, I made a bad decision and you cut me off for it, the millennia. Mm-hmm. He says, look what you did to my brother and let mm-hmm. him suffer when you could have eased his suffering. Mm-hmm. And to me, that offers a level of emotional maturity from mm-hmm. Lucifer that we don't usually see.
Yeah.
You know,
we definitely would not have seen in season one.
Agreed. Not at all. He had mm-hmm. zero empathy for his brother in season one. I mean, and he does it all like while he's like shoving food in his mouth and talking with his mouth full, which is really unpleasant. But you know, that's something that stood out to me. And then even more so as you were talking about that confrontation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in that scene, moment of overthinking, we've talked about names before. Haysbert, and they mispronounce it. It wouldn't have been Michael. It would have been Michael. And they don't have the ch either. But mm-hmm. even like an Americanized version, it should be Michael because it, anyway. Small thing, maybe even fluff, but it like as they were like, yeah, I kind of like the sound of that. Michael, or whatever he said. And I was like, no,
Michael,
no. You know, can we move on from the dinner itself?
Absolutely.
So the other moment that I want to talk about and think about is Maze, mm-hmm. and when Maze comes to talk to God when she's mm-hmm. dressed like Little Red Riding Hood, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. inexplicably. Yeah, that scene again, like I forget about it when I haven't mm-hmm. recently rewatched. I think in part because it is so heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
That she feels this lack, which is ultimately loneliness. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have a hard time making a connection, she says. You know, mm-hmm. and when he says you're perfect just as you are, like she just can't hear that.
Well, that's one of those where like it can feel like a slap in the face.
Yeah, clearly.
When you're convinced that there's something wrong with you and someone else says, no, of course there's not. And you're like, what's wrong with you that you can't see this? Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love that this show, I feel like for the most part does such a good job, like showing and discussing mental health, even when it's not doing it directly, because that is a very clear, I feel like I've mentioned this at some point before, but it reminded me of how after Robin Williams died, was reading an opinion article by a comedian talking about how you know that a comedian considers you a friend when they're not funny in front of you. And, you know, and if you are like, hey, where's the funny guy or something like that, they'll put the mask back up and it will be a complete surprise. Now, with Williams, there was clearly something, the Lewy body dementia and all of that, which was only somewhat related to like his lifelong depression. But I'm just thinking about that. That's like when she takes off she shows her real face.
Demon face. Uh-huh.
Her demon face and says like, do you think this is perfect? That is so real for someone who is experiencing self-loathing in that, like, you know, how can you possibly think that I'm perfect just as I am when I'm this horrible creature. And in part because God is so remote, and this is the first time she's, I think, met him, it's going to be impossible to take that from him. Whereas I feel like if Amenadiel had said it, she might have been able to hear some portion of it.
Maybe.
Maybe. It's, but yes, that was just heartbreaking. I have to say, I love the through line of him always having the exact right drink for someone.
When she like, it's all right. And then he turns his back and she's like, oh, so funny. I don't, and Leslie Ann Brandt, like the way that she like, just like, mess your whole mouth in that like martini glass. That was pretty great.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was pretty great. You know, then the next scene when we see her talking to Michael at Lux, we already don't like Michael. The writers have already given us plenty of reason to despise Michael, which, you know, Lucifer makes clean when he says what Michael has done since he's been on Earth. And again, in that scene, I mean, there's a moment of connection between him and Maze over their disdain for God, which like makes him all the more, you know, despicable because not only because they're planting the seeds so that we can start to realize that not only is he duplicitous with his siblings and humans, he's also being duplicitous with his father, which I think that's the first time we see that seed. Like, we maybe suspect that he's not being fully truthful. Like, surely he didn't tell God that he was going to go down and like try and break Lucifer's life before he left the Silver City. But, you know, I'll stay with you and let's go back. Like all that that we just saw when Haysbert's God says that's a bad
smarmy
idea to go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the conversation with Maze then makes that the conversation with Dad all the more smarmy, which is really an interesting also setup for us around Haysbert's God, that because you're not sure, does he know, does he not know? And that adds to the layers of complexity that they're trying to give us with him by having him banish, I'm putting quotes around that, Michael, while sticking around to spend time with Lucifer. Anyway,
the thing that struck me in that scene is even as despicable as Michael is, it was proof that Maze is not correct when she says she can't connect with people, because she does connect with Michael, and in a genuine way, like he's not playing her at that point,
right?
Even though he's always playing somebody, and he connects with her in a way that she can hear. And she's like, oh, what? You come to say goodbye? He's like, well, all the people, I don't entirely hate you, which is like high praise for Maze. And like, oh, he's all right. And I found that scene, watching it again this time, I found it endearing's too strong, but it was like, there is something in Michael that is worthwhile in that he did make sure to talk to Maze because she was someone he had connected with for whatever reason. And that, like, as dickish as Michael is and as despicable as he will become, what's coming up, there's still the opportunity for growth. There's still the opportunity for him to become better than what he is. And I appreciate that just because that's what the show is about.
That is the undercurrent of the whole show. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's move on to the other episode, the
Bloody Celestial, Celestial Karaoke Jam.
So this is like kind of fluffy, but that first scene when he's singing the Wicked Ways.
Wicked Game, yeah.
Wicked Game, right. Thank you.
When he kicks over the bench, the piano bench. Oh.
So I saw they actually, the director wanted it, like they had to film it in slow-mo because of the spin. Mm-hmm. So he actually was singing in double time.
Oh.
So that, I think that they overdub him singing in a studio.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But he was singing in double time so that the lips would match.
Wow.
When they slowed it down to slow-mo.
Wow.
Right?
That's so cool.
I know.
Yeah. So the
thing that I saw that talked about it, the director was like, yeah, he's such a trooper. I told him we had to do it double time. And he was like, okay.
Well, the director is Sherwin Shalotti, who he's the one who did God Johnson back in season two, I think.
Uh-huh.
Where he did that gorgeous like panning shot of
the chaos in the
psychiatric ward. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, yeah, that fits. That this is.
Is he the one who did the one with Detective Amenadiel?
I don't know. I meant to look, because I think he's also the one who did, you can't just go in there and say, hello, drug dealers. He's like, I never do that. And then he did it in Korean. I think he's the same director of that.
All right, pause. I'm going to look it up. Okay, so it's not the same guy as the Detective Amenadiel episode. Mm-hmm. That was Nathan Hope. I was wondering, because there's a similar moment of the camera sort of following and turning upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, I would never have picked up on that in my first mm-hmm. run through, but watching for these, for you and I, you know, in mm-hmm. my conversation, I noticed those sorts of directorial choices. And it was interesting in this case, because with that tree,
like chandelier, yeah,
has been a focal point often mm-hmm. throughout mm-hmm. the previous five seasons. And so that upside down scene, we've seen the reflection of it to make it right side up as a tree. It's been there a lot. And so to have mm-hmm. it like flip upside down here, I was like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm overthinking it. I don't know. I don't know what it meant. Mm-hmm. but okay. I noticed it.
I would like to have an overthinking logistical moment. So Lucifer wakes up. He sings Wicked Game. Beautifully, I might add. And his father comes in. We're never entirely clear if he would have sung that on his own or if that was God. We're told it's 4 a.m. He gets a text.
And then she says, I'm surprised you're here. It's been 4 hours. I noticed that too.
Now, here's the question I have. When was that guy killed?
And all those people were there at a game at 4 a.m? That seems unlikely. I think that was a mistake.
Yeah. Because I was sitting there thinking, I was just like, okay, even if it had happened overnight or like the night before, let's say like 8 p.m. game, 9 p.m. game, maybe even late, maybe it was, and they were like,
be there?
Well, I was thinking they'd be there if they needed to. So let's say it was a late game.
Okay.
It took a minute for them to realize like this was a murder and not just a death. Cause they said Ella, he thought he was. Yeah.
Ella figured out it was a murder.
Yeah. So like if they knew it was a murder, I could understand them saying like, nobody can go anywhere. We got to interview everybody. I could see that, but not for 12 hours.
No.
And like, I don't know how hot it is in Los Angeles. And I don't know what time of year this is, but like those cheerleading outfits do not cover much. And if they were sitting outside overnight.
No. And also, like, logistically, if they thought he was having a heart attack, they would have done CPR.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever gave him mouth to mouth would have also been poisoned.
Mm. That is a good point.
Assuming they didn't have one of those bags. But yeah.
So, but yeah, if they thought he was having a heart attack, he would have been at the hospital.
Yeah. He wouldn't have still been on the field.
Yeah.
And that, I texted you 4 hours ago. That whole timeline just does not make sense. I have a feeling there was like a different storyline, like maybe mm-hmm. another text that ended up on the cutting room floor or something, because mm-hmm. it just didn't make sense.
Does not make sense. Yeah. So, and it was like they needed everyone to be there so that they could have the big musical number, obviously.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, like, if his murder had been accomplished in a different way, it would have made more sense. Or if it had been like clearly murder and like the same night, or it was a day game.
Yeah, something about that whole sequence like is missing. I think. Our writers are too good to have not seen that. I have a feeling something ended up on the cutting room floor that would have made sense of that.
Yeah.
Like maybe there was a text at 4 a.m. from her because she was clearly up that he ignored. And maybe there was another one, you know, at 8 and now it's noon.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah.
Because it just doesn't, I agree.
Yeah. So if it were like a Saturday morning game at 10 a.m.
Yeah. Or yeah.
So I do want to say, all right, so the musical numbers, we have Wicked Game by Chris Isaacs. We've got Queen's Another One Bites the Dust. We've got Every Breath You Take by The Police, but as sung by Debbie Gibson. We've got In the Afterlife by the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
And then there's that mashup of Bad to the Bone.
Oh, Bad to the Bone and Scrubs. TLC's Scrubs. And then there's I Dreamed a Dream from...
Is it from Broadway? What is that?
Yeah, it's from Les Mis. It's Fantine's song.
Okay.
Basically, this is again clear to me.
Gen Xers are making this TV show.
Gen Xers. It's just like, oh, bless you. And they may even be like Oregon Trail generation like us. We're like not quite full Gen Xers, but definitely in high school in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Late 80s and early 90s at the latest. And I love it so much. Yeah. I remember seeing people talking about this episode and they're like, I don't know that In the Afterlife song. And I was just like, oh, clearly you were in high school in 1996. Like, how did you not know this song? Do you not remember the swing revival in the mid 90s?
Yeah. Yeah. What we were all trying to put this suits back on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just, it's one of those things where like Gen X is often forgotten about, you know, you see like, you know, it's millennials versus boomers. And we're like, hey, that's okay. We'll let ourselves in and get ourselves a snack. It's
well,
fine.
We've been doing it for forever.
Yeah. We were the latchkey generation. So like, whatever, squabble all you want. We're going to be over here making ourselves a grilled cheese and watching MASH on reruns in the afternoon while we do our homework.
Right. We raised our own damn selves.
We did. Yeah. But so, and I like, this is one of those things, I don't know if this is actually true, but sometimes it feels like there are things that are like meant to appeal to boomers, and they're like, there are things that are meant to appeal to millennials. They're like, oh yeah, this is gonna, you know, just shove this in, they're gonna love it. And so like this, I'm just like, I'm okay with being appealed to.
This is kind of my turn, damn it.
I'm down with this music. So I was singing along as I watched. This time around.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about at the very end what was really, and so we don't get into the specifics exactly here, but this is again, as talked about mental health, it's like an adult child seeing their parent experience like dementia or Alzheimer's or something along those lines, or just losing mobility, losing independence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Decline in general.
Yes. And the way that Tom Ellis is able to go from angry, overwhelmed with sadness, resentful at what his father has done to him to like, oh my God, dad, are you okay? With one word.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and his face.
Face. And it reminded me of how, you know, growing up partially is about learning that your parents are real people. And recognizing that, you know, they do the best they can, but they're people, they're, you know, they're flawed human beings. And so you go from, you know, a child who is like worshiping your parents to like the teenager who's rebelling against them to an adult who's like, you know, counting on them to in some way or another to like recognizing like, oh gosh, they're not eternal. And that is like he instantly wasn't worried about his resentments anymore.
The complication of their relationship actually across these two episodes is really interesting too, where he in the previous episode, he recognizes that, I mean, he says at the dinner table, if all the apples are rotten, maybe there's a problem with the tree. And then when they catch the killer, mm-hmm. and it turns out to be the girlfriend, and the dad is also there. Mm-hmm. And
because the dad sacrificed himself because he was afraid he'd lose another child.
And so did his kid. And mm-hmm. She's like, get the gun, because he's like off in his head. And that's the moment he's realizing. That's the moment the character is realizing that he is incapable of loving. Mm-hmm. That's what he thinks, because mm-hmm. he told his father was incapable of loving. And then he said the thing about the tree and the apples. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that was actually beautifully written, mm-hmm. so that I could string those breadcrumbs together.
Yeah. Yeah. That through line is very clear.
And then he says that to Chloe episode. And now in this second episode in the karaoke jam, at that very end where you're talking about, where Ellis so beautifully brings us along on a quite a long emotional journey, very, very quickly, mm-hmm. from one to another. I mean, there's something really similar too about like the push and pull of the ways in which we are alike and not like, the ways we mm-hmm. are the same and separate from our parents, mm-hmm. that I think is really human and resonant mm-hmm. and interesting, mm-hmm. that I really appreciate it in these two episodes, and further the power of chosen family too. I mean, even mm-hmm. in Chloe, when she's like, no, mm-hmm. I don't believe it. And mm-hmm. the way she says, I have faith in you, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is like, it's a thing that one might say to someone else, to a, you know, a friend, a human.
I just remembered another song. So just the two of us, but the Will Smith version.
Oh, there's also the one that Trixie sings.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Smile,
that's an old standard.
The world smiles with you.
Yes. Sorry. Sorry. It hit me because I was thinking about like parenting and family, and Amenadiel saying like, let me be mortal instead. And so one of the things that I found really odd in parenting was when like particularly my eldest was tiny, like I knew he was separate from me. I knew he was a different person from me, but it wasn't until he went to a language intensive preschool when he was like 2.5, 3 years old, and he took a bus to go, and he was so excited, and I wasn't there with him, and I wasn't experiencing it with him. And that was the first time it really hit me, is like, he is his own person doing his own thing that is not about me. And like, obviously, you know, like, of course, but there was this emotional sense of like, of a separation that had not been there before. And I was reminded of that with Amenadiel, like, you know, like, let me be the one who is mortal, because there is this sense of like, I am my child is me. I will take on what is difficult so my child doesn't have to have it. My child doesn't have to do it.
You know, interestingly, in these two episodes, we get a sort of spectrum of that, you know, from Amenadiel, which is, if futile, maybe also healthy, mm-hmm. To Debbie Gibson's character.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Where,
yeah.
She's still so wrapped up in them being the same person. She doesn't even know
who her son is.
Who yeah. this 17-year-old kid is.
Yeah.
Who is her son, JJ. Yeah.
And that's one of those things where like, I remember when that happened, and I had that, like that odd feeling, and it was uncomfortable. And I remember thinking like, oh, I can kind of understand how like overbearing and narcissistic parents can do that, is because like when that happened, it was uncomfortable. And I was like, I just need to embrace this, because this is what I'm doing. This is what the point is, you know? And you know, other folks who aren't as, you know, introspective or are more uncomfortable with discomfort might be like, nope, they're me, I'm them, you know. But that's, yeah, it's, what's also interesting is that that also kind of from the other side of it, you know, Lucifer as the child is, you know, I've read that, you know, very tiny children have trouble differentiating between themselves and their caretakers, you know, when it makes sense. And so this like separation that Lucifer and Dennis Haysbert's character, I struggle to call him God.
Right.
have gone through is, it's kind of like the, you know, the realization that they are separate, you know, the child's realization that they're separate, which I suspect must be kind of traumatic depending on how it happens and when it happens. And then moving through like all of the stages of anger and resentment and all of that. And then the reminder again, but that there is a separation between them, but they are connected when seeing a parent's vulnerability. Just to overthink it a lot. By the way, part of the reason why I struggle to call Dennis Haysbert God is because God's pronouns are God.
Right, right.
So I do not like doing using he, him pronouns with God.
Yeah, I'm with you. I want to come back to something I was talking about, though.
Yes, I'm sorry. I interrupted you. And then
when Chloe says that she has faith in Lucifer, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the significance, I mean, that is a sentence that I might say to a friend, right? Mm-hmm. And also she's not just saying it to another human being. She's saying it to the devil. And I think there's something really fascinating and interesting mm-hmm. about saying to the devil, I have faith in you. Mm-hmm. In particular, because what she's saying is, I have faith that you are capable of love. Mm-hmm. That's what she's saying to mm-hmm. the devil. Mm-hmm. And the use of that word faith, I don't think is coincidental or accidental on the part mm-hmm. of our writers. Mm-hmm. It may be on the part of Chloe Decker, but not on the part of our writers.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
And I find that really fascinating and very satisfying. Mm. And I think it actually gave him, I want to go back and rewatch that scene now that I'm mm-hmm. talking about it, mm-hmm. because it goes pretty quickly where he just feels overwhelmed and like he's disappointing her. He's letting her down and he knows it. And he just feels like he just feels broken. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, because in the next scene, his dad says, I can't fix you. Mm-hmm. And he says, you can or you won't. Right. And like the reaction is, the reaction is not, I don't need to be fixed. He wants mm-hmm. to be fixed. He thinks he's broken. So having her say that, I don't know. There's something mm-hmm. like deeply beautiful mm-hmm. to me mm-hmm. about having this human being who we've established is one of the few who can actually see him.
Yes. Yeah.
Say it in that way. Mm-hmm. Not mm-hmm. just, I love you. I have faith in you. Mm-hmm. I think that's really significant. And like, I just, if y'all ever see it, like Joe, Ildi, whoever wrote this, I saw it and it's beautiful. And mm-hmm. thank you.
Yeah. It made me realize that how similar Maze's story and Lucifer's story are in these two episodes. Cause she's having the same reaction. Like I there's something wrong with me. I can't fix it. You need to fix it.
And the connection is what's missing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm broken. She's saying I'm broken because I don't have a soul. And that's why I can't connect. He's saying I'm broken because I'm his kid mm-hmm. and I'm incapable of love. But mm-hmm. both are saying, you're right. Different versions of the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm incapable or I'm unworthy.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's interesting is that the reaction, like Haysbert's reaction in both cases is like, that's, you know, you are you. And so when he says, I can't fix you, it's because there's nothing to be fixed. And that's, I don't know. There is something to like him saying you wanted his kids to have free will and, you know, part of what's going on here is like, you know, there's nothing to be fixed, and you also need to work this out on your own. You need to be an emotional latchkey kid.
Well, you have to. I can't fix you. He says, I can't fix you, Lucifer. Only Lucifer can fix Lucifer, because there's nothing wrong with Lucifer.
We're both back and forth muting our mic because of the loudness in our houses.
Maybe that's a sign from the universe that it's time for us to say we've overthunk it enough. Do you have any fluff you want to share?
I do. I've got one piece of fluff, which is, it's one of those, like, it's a continuity issue in Family Dinner. At the end, Lucifer takes off his tie and he gets up and he throws it on top of the platter of chicken.
I thought that was his napkin.
It was a tie.
It's his tie.
And I know because I went back because I was just like, what the heck is that? And like, it was grossed me out that he put it on the platter of chicken too. Cause I'm like, and what? And then the very next scene, like it's less than 5 seconds later, the platter is moved further to the left and the tie is on the table to the right of it. And I was just like, oh, I wish I hadn't noticed that.
I read that as a napkin, but I did see him take the tie off because he's like, I'm done with this. And he like starts taking the tie off. Yeah. I don't know if this counts. It's so loud here. I don't know if this counts as fluff, but the scene when Dennis Haysbert comes in with the tray, the breakfast tray, and Lucifer sleeping on his tummy on the couch naked, and then he sits up. And so we're just like graced with this like chest and collarbones of Tom Ellis. And like, that's my sexual orientation. That scene with the chest and the collarbones and the coffee and the like, the little, like and, there's this one piece of hair.
Yes. And when he is like, it's a little bit bitter. Like the noise he made.
Yes. That's it. That is my current sexual orientation. It may change, but right now, that's it.
Can I just say, it's just overthinking it. He's like, Dad? And I'm like, you're sleeping on the sofa in an open plan.
And we know he has pajamas because we saw them when he was playing Wicked Game. Like, put on your pajamas, buddy.
And I'm like, why are you sleeping naked when your dad's right there? It's like 15 feet away.
I mean, it was a nice, funny scene because it's like, I've seen naked. If I had a nickel for all the time, like,
yeah,
that was very funny. And also, we know he owns pajamas. We've seen them
recently.
Yeah.
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 One other thing I do want to mention real quick is Ella trying to get back to her normal self after everything that's happened. I wish that we'd given her a little bit more time in these couple of episodes, but I really appreciated the conversation that Dan has with her. And the fact that when he's like, he had all of us fooled, and she's like, oh yeah, yeah, of course, that's right. Cause you slept with him too. And it, like, she's like, yeah, Dan, that's not helpful. You know, she has a very different experience. And like, honestly, I don't know how one gets over the ick factor of knowing that you were intimate with someone who was that evil. But I like Dan's trying, and I appreciate it. I really appreciate that he's trying. So that, I just wanted to give a little moment to that.
Yeah. 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 And the way that Ella, like, in fact, in the way that Ella is like talking about it is, like, they don't, her friends don't know what to do or say, you know? And she's like, oh, I know who did it. Just introduce me to all of the suspects, and whichever one I'm most attracted to, that's the one that did it. Like,
yeah.
I don't blame Ella for saying or thinking or feeling that way. And also, like, I also don't blame her friends for, like, not knowing what to say.
Yeah. I also, I appreciated where, like, Chloe's like, Dan, go home. And he's like, oh, I need to work. And he's like, you were kidnapped. You should stay home. And then they're like, at least Ella's at home. Oh, it's Ella. And they're like, we're not going to argue with you.
Yeah. But she's like, really? I have like 5 or 6 arguments. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I really think we should call it. I'm calling it.
Okay. Have we overthunk it enough?
We have overthinking.
Oh my goodness, so much overthinking.
Our theme song is Feral Angel Waltz by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons, by Attribution 4.0 license. Visit the show notes for the URL. I am an artificially generated voice, powered by Narrakeep.com. Lucifer is a Warner Brothers production that first aired on Fox and then Netflix. Tracy and Emily are not affiliated with Fox, Netflix, nor WB. If you liked this episode, subscribe to keep overthinking with them, and visit the show notes for other ways to connect.